Welcome back to 1001 Albums Podcast. Today I'm talking to Nils Lofgren, who has a great new album out called Weathered, about Neil Young's After the Gold Rush.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come and saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s. Look at Mother Nature on the run in the 1970s.
Welcome to 1001 Albums Podcast, Nils Lofgren.
Glad to be with you, James. Sounds like a great project.
It's been good fun. It's been really good fun, actually, because, it's just such a, you know, for instance, in the last sort of three interviews I've done, I've been with Andy from OMD, this, you know, British synth pop band, and then Louis Prima Jr., the son of Louis Prima, the great old jazz and jive guy. So, and then yourself.
Sure.
It's really interesting to jump around all these different... different people, but the one thing is that they've had this place in musical history.
Yeah, now is it the 1001 albums of all time, or do you have a time frame?
Well, this is what I'm doing. I'm based off, there's a famous book, it was mainly published over here, called The 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die. And it's mainly this British author called Rob Dimmery, but then he's drawn on loads of others. And there's been about six different editions of it over the last sort of 15 years.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I thought, well, I wonder how many you're on, and you're on three of them, which is
I am good.
Yeah, which is pretty cool, really. That, you know, because there's not that many people that are on multiple albums for multiple artists. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I'll take it.
But the one of the things that is even it's really, really interesting as well, is that you've got a new album coming, which is a live album called Weathered. And it's, I tell you what, I really, really enjoyed listening to it over the last couple of days. But it did make me feel really bad, Nils, because we can't go out to any gigs. I'm listening to this, such a fantastic atmosphere and such great playing, and it just, I felt awful listening to it.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons I realized, because I didn't intend to record a live record. I just wanted to go play town to town with great friends and a band, and improvise every night, have it be different, and just have it be a snapshot for the people in the room each night. But just before we left, my wife Amy implored us to record them just to have, and sure enough, after the tour, I started listening with no intent or plan to make a live record, and I realized there was something special going on with this group that I should share. And also, that was made even more clear to me by the pandemic and the fact that not only can't I go sing or play for anybody, but we go out to shows fairly regularly here in Arizona, and that stopped too. So you're right, it's frustrating that part of life has dried up. There's untold damage being done to the psyche of the planet, and but that's one of the highlights for us, was always, you know, getting out pretty regularly and hearing great live music. So another reason why I felt I should share this record, and I understand why it maybe reminded you of that handicap for all of us right now.
Oh, no, it's hard. And I know something that a lot of the other musicians that I've spoken to have made the point that it's a for the more established people that have maybe got royalty payments and things like that, or have got, you know, have done very well over the years, it's a bit easier. But for the road crew and for the backing bands and for the it's such a tough time for them.
No, it's awful for everybody, and past the financial, which is huge, because that's how you feed your family and maintain your home, just psychologically, you know, to, if you're a performer that does that a lot, and it's kind of the life's blood of what you do, there's a whole, you know, emotional depression that goes along with it, just like every other, you know, job and person that can't get out and do what they do anymore. But in particular with performing, it's just a unique thing that you never really thought that would disappear. It's been, just been such a mainstay of my life for 52 years. Next month, actually, it'll be my 52 years on the road.
Wow.
And counting. And I've never been in this spot where I didn't have a tour to plan or work toward. Earlier in the year, I was, you know, joyously playing, just jamming along with Neil Young's songs. We were going to start April 29th in Chicago, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and go out for a few months. And I was so excited about that. And I was hoping to take this weathered band out at the end of the year, maybe over to the UK and Europe. And then had high hopes next year might be a long year of playing with Bruce and E Street. So I had an unusual year and a half planned out in my heart, in my head. I was very excited about it, and poof, it's all gone. So, but yeah, look, we've got enormous challenges, and God bless all the doctors and nurses, and frontline workers that are out there every day risking their lives for all of us and saving our lives. And, you know, just tragically, that's going to continue till we get a better handle on. I mean, in this country in particular, we're doing an awful job, and the world's watching us do this awful job at great cost, you know, with life itself, and, you know, depression, the emotional toll, the fear of unemployment, or what do I do now? It's just, it's a horrendous challenge and chapter for the whole planet. In our country in particular, here in the States. So, yeah, we're in for it, man. We definitely miss the normalcy, and one of the highlights for me was singing and playing and going out and hear people sing and play for us.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And like one of the tracks you play on here, because it's a really interesting mix of your own solo work, really, and from all the whole like range of your career, and one of the tracks you do, which I hadn't heard before, I wasn't aware of this one, is Rock or Not, and it really jumped out to me. This really felt relevant in 2020 with everything that's going on, especially in your country. And, you know, and you think your generation, Nils, you said, you know, it was so powerful, the music that was coming out of you, you know, you and your bandmates at the various points said so much and spoke to so many people. And a track like that just feels so relevant today.
Yeah, you know, it's my most recent studio record called Blue with Lou, featuring six songs I wrote with the great Lou Reed. And this was one in particular. It just came out a year and a half ago, so it is a fairly new track. And we were already mired in a very dark political chapter, and, you know, just a bad chapter in our history of, you know, I was at the civil rights marches with Grin playing in 68, and you would have hoped, you know, 52 years later, we would have been more evolved as a human race and a planet and a country, and we're not. And it's very kind of a horrific thing to realize and navigate. My wife Amy is a fierce Twitter warrior. She goes to bat every day for women's rights, children's rights, human rights, and very, you know, vocal about it, and I'm proud of her. But I had the title Rock or Not a couple years ago. I was starting to write this record, actually. I just jumped into it and started writing in earnest at the end of the River Tour when we were in Australia, and brushing off the Lou Reed songs that no one had ever heard I wanted to share. But I thought, oh, Rock or Not, that'll be a great party song. And but as things got more and more ominous, I just realized, I don't want to waste this title on a party song. And I really, you know, Amy is also does a lot of reading, nonfiction, and we talk a lot about the great women in history, like, you know, Malala and Carmen de Lavallade and Rosa Parks, on and on and on. There's just a great, you know, history of women doing great work behind the scenes a lot and not noticed a lot. So I decided to write a much more powerful song and a more serious song, kind of a protest song, based in rage and hope for a better future, and that's where that came from. But I'm glad you like it.
No, I really enjoyed that one. I mean, it must be tough because you have got such this, you know, this such a huge career behind you that. How do you go about choosing the set list? And also, I know that this album is a amalgamation of all these different shows that you mentioned that you could sort of pick and choose. So in terms of on a night-by-night basis, are you saying to the band, right, this is what we're doing tonight, or are you kind of calling out tunes as they go and keeping them on their toes?
Yeah, you know, I've done, I mean, all kinds of shows, a lot of improv. Look, the last few shows I did with Neil Young and Crazy Horse up in Winnipeg, we thought it was hilarious because, you know, usually what I'll do, you write a set list. You know, you'll just give everyone an idea of what you're thinking for that night. On this particular tour, the Weathered Tour, I usually change, you know, 3 to 5 songs a night. But inside the set, of course, we kept it loose, and if I was not feeling what I was looking at on the set list, I just give everyone notice, say, hey, I don't feel like singing that, let's sing this one.
Yeah.
And, you know, give everyone time to change the instrument or whatever. I've done, you know, the extremes are, you know, with Bruce and the E Street Band, Bruce never follows a set list. It's just an idea of what he's thinking. You know he's not going to follow it. We usually do songs, you know, take signs and do songs we never played in our lives together, nightly. And then, you know, the other extreme, the Neil Young shows in Winnipeg, you know, Neil would write a set list. We wouldn't follow it, but at least he had an idea of what he was thinking. And we were doing vocal warm-ups, and it was like 20 below zero. It was just bitter cold. Had a great crowd in the theater, and Neil looked at it and said, guys, I don't feel like writing a set list. Why don't we just walk out and play whatever we feel? So that was the other extreme. You walk on stage and you literally do not have a single song written on a piece of paper to follow, nothing. And you just, but it's beautiful, you know, because you have the material, you have the old friendship, you have, you know, this 50-year-plus history working with these dear friends, and you have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of great songs.
Yeah.
So that was really neat.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot of confidence and freedom. So in my set, we would, you know, I'd call things out. What we did change a lot was jamming. I mean, some nights we just do hellacious jams. We never played the song the same twice. I don't like doing that. I like giving the musicians freedom to surprise me with their great ideas. And, you know, one of my favorites is, I mean, I don't know if I've ever put out a 15-minute-plus version of anything. And I got a 15-minute-plus version of I Came to Dance with a great jam at the front of it, where we just fell into Papa Was a Rolling Stone accidentally one night.
Little louder, Atlanta.
Daddy, Papa was a rolling stone.
a lot of times what I did here, I say, you know, I'm sick of hearing myself play. Andy, Kevin, why don't you start off and just do a jam? I'll come in when I feel like it. And everyone was free to just jump in, come in and out. And it was fun to just go off, you know, have a strong cup of coffee or drink some water, sit there with my brother Tommy, watch Andy and Kevin go at it. And they didn't know what they were going to do.
That's
they just,
amazing.
You know, hey, entertain us. And every night was vastly different. But this particular night, we got a great jam in the front and end of I Came to Dance. And it was fun to share a 15-minute track on a record. It's something I'd never done. So there's always new firsts, and that's how, you know, this tour went. It was loose, but I did write a set list.
Yeah. I love, there's a brilliant little intro that you do when you talk about Ringo, because I know as well as being part of the, you know, maybe two of the greatest bands in history, and the E Street Band and Crazy Horse, you were also part of the All-Star Band, and a good few appearances with a good few sort of tours with the All-Star Band as well. And you tell a lovely story about Ringo, like listening to this song and giving you a bit of advice. I mean, that's just great.
Yeah, I mean, I was honored to be in the first two All-Star Bands with Ringo in 89 and 92. I gotten to be friends with him on the Born USA tour. And we stayed in touch. I was living in L.A., and I'd see him in England every time. I mean, I'd go over there and tour every year, and he'd come to my shows. And we maintained a friendship that I was so grateful for, because really the Beatles have the greatest body of recorded music in history, I think. And it was they that got me off of classical accordion. Nothing wrong with classical accordion. But I fell in love with all rock and roll through the Beatles and Stones, the British Invasion, the American counterparts, Stax Volt, Motown, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Little Richard, on and on. All of that I discovered through the Beatles. Mm. And to me, you know, the Beatles and the Stones remain two of the most powerful, you know, greatest bands in history. And to help Ringo go out and sing and play in 89 and 92 was a great honor. But he had come down to play on Walkin' Nerve, which he did. We played live in the studio and cut this power trio track with me and Kevin McCormick, who was producing and playing bass. And it was just one of the highlights of my life. In fact, the groove to Walkin' Nerve, which is a song about kind of being young and crazy and all the angst that goes with youth in a troubled world, I used to play that riff at the sound checks in 89, at the Ringo sound checks. And, you know, Ringo has this great shuffle beat that he does in an unusual way. Instead of using both hands, one hand just does the backbeat. Jim Keltner, our great drummer and friend, would point out how unusual it was that he would get that shuffle feel all with one hand. And so, you know, I wrote this song eventually, but at the time I just had the riff, and I'd play it, and Billy Preston would come out and jump on the organ and start singing She's a Woman in a blues format to that riff. It was just high times for a young musician who was inspired by the Beatles to wind up, you know, decades later being in a band with that cast of characters. I mean, that first band was just insane. You know, you had Dr. John, Billy Preston, Rick Danko, Levon Helm, me and Joe Walsh on guitars, Clarence Clemons on sax, Jim Keltner on drums, you know, Levon. Sometimes we had three drummers with Levon, or he'd sing and play mandolin, and just extraordinary band. But I was blessed to go out with that. And so anyway, fast forward, I've written a song, we're going to record it. And Ringo came to the sessions early to hang out with us and just get the vibe. And we had tracked this, you know, very beautiful trio version of Girl in Motion based around this beautiful harmonic bass part that Kevin McCormick wrote. And we came in and we were listening. And, of course, me and Kevin are wondering, what are we going to add? We're thinking synths, guitars, harmonies. That's what you do. You produce. You think, okay, well, we got a track. Now what do we do? Might this be the track? Because it felt pretty good. But, you know, you're very hypercritical of yourself to a fault, I think, when you're making records. And that's something you have to try to get out of your own way constantly on. But in this case, we played the playback listening, and we were starting to think, well, maybe we have our basic track here now, and what are we going to do with it, or do we need to play it again? And through the silence, you know, Ringo spoke up and said, well, you're done. And we looked at him and said, what do you mean? He said, well, that was gorgeous, that was beautiful, you're not going to you know, muck it up by adding a lot of stuff. I mean, why mess with that? It sounded beautiful. And it was only a guy of that caliber, musician and you know, person with that kind of track record as a musician, that could convince me and Kevin to completely ignore our instincts and experiment ad infinitum for weeks to get back to hopefully that same decision, and probably not. We probably would have added stuff. And we were blessed to have Ringo there to say, hey, don't mess with it. It's beautiful. You're done.
I love that. That's not bad, is it? When you go Ringo there. For us. I bet.
I know a girl with a new blue dress, ready to meet a stranger with good intentions. She's so tender with no corners at all. She is one of nature's unique inventions.
That's absolutely fantastic. And that album, it did feature like Billy Preston, and Ringo played drums in a couple of tracks as well, didn't he? It's a, you know, you're blessed to have had all these guest stars.
You know, he played drums, and one of my fun moments, I had a song that we did on the tour called Being Angry. Being Angry is a full-time job. And, I said, hey, you know, Richie, do you want to maybe try singing a harmony on Being Angry? And he said, well, I don't sing harmony. Because, of course, he has a lot of hit singles, singing great lead vocals. Great singing voice. And I was like, well, man, I'd love to hear your voice. Do you think, would you consider giving it a try? And he looked at me and paused a second and went, all right, I'll give it a try, but I'm not a harmony singer. But we got him in front of a mic, and, you know, we just played the track, and he right away sang a harmony right above me, that in the chorus, Being Angry is a full-time job. It sounded great. It was just what I was hoping for. It was the great Ringo Starr singing a harmony on my record. We said, that's fabulous. You're done. You did it. It's complete. And it was so great because he said, you know what? Give me another track. I've got another idea. And so we sent the track back out to him, and he sang a third part harmony to himself and my lead vocal. So for a man who can't sing harmony and never has, within a half an hour, he'd sung two different great tracks of harmony to himself and me. And, it was such a stunning kind of reminder of like, yeah, this is that attitude and fearlessness is why the Beatles are the Beatles, past the songwriting and everything else. And we all know the great history that, you know, that served them so well of playing thousands of hours in funky nightclubs and bars that, you know, led to George Martin having that kind of, you know, muscular, powerful ensemble that could play together and were so good at it. But it was just another great moment in the studio with, you know, one of my musical heroes and friends.
Because I know being angry is a full-time job. Being angry is a full-time job. Can't you see it yourself?
Taking it back then, like you were saying about growing up and getting into the Beatles and the Stones, if we just move on to sort of have a chat about the Neil Young After the Gold Rush album, because that sort of ties in with obviously your becoming a professional musician for the first time. And I've heard you tell the story before about sort of, you know, hustling your way backstage and speaking to Neil Young when he came to Washington and you were just 17. But taking it back a bit before that, Nils, were you a big Neil Young fan? I'm just trying to get my head around. Were you a fan of Buffalo Springfield at the time? Had you heard Neil's first album, or was it just another band coming through Washington?
No, it was a bit of the first. of course, quickly after falling in love with rock and roll and being, you know, I had little cover bands. We'd play at teen clubs locally, cover bands. Nobody in the 60s in America ever thought you could do that for a living. No one. But we loved the great songs coming out, and we'd learn them as best we could and play them. So a couple years into, you know, being a guitar player, and I went to see The Who and Herman's Hermits and Blues Magoos. They did an amazing show. And then we rushed across town to see Jimi Hendrix Experience. Pete Townsend was in the audience. And I was so blown away that night that I left the Ambassador Theater where Jimi Hendrix played, kind of possessed with the idea of trying to be a rock musician, which I'd never thought of. I never thought, well, you can't be a professional rock musician in middle-class America. But I was possessed with that notion, and kind of that led to me leaving school early, running away to the Greenwich Village in New York, trying to find work, striking out, putting Grin together, becoming a big local band. We failed some auditions in New York, and we were set to go to L.A. to look for a record deal, now being a professional band, you know, just scratching by. And I had a habit of sneaking backstage to ask for advice from musical heroes when I could, because we didn't know anything. And yes, because of that explosion of music a few years earlier in the early mid-60s that the Beatles and Stones spearheaded, I had discovered the American counterpart of the British Invasion, which Buffalo Springfield, the Byrds, many, many great bands, but they're at the top of the list. So I was a big fan of Neil's through the Buffalo Springfield. I wasn't aware of him as a solo artist, but I knew he was a great writer, singer, and player. So I went to see his first tour, Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and I snuck backstage at the cellar door where I knew the dressing room. There wasn't security, and I walked in on muddy waters. He let me stay in the room, watch him play cards. People would play two shows a night in this tiny little 200-seater with a wraparound balcony, so you were on top of the musician. It was really an intimate place. And Neil was there with Crazy Horse, and so I snuck back and, you know, asked him for some advice, and he asked if we had songs. I said, yeah, I wrote songs for Grin. We're going to L.A. look for a record deal. And he had a Martin on practicing, and he handed me his guitar and said, sing me a song. And I sang him a song from the first Grin album and said, that's good, sing another one, please. And I did, and after about four or five songs, he said, hey, those are really good. Why don't you hang out with us for a couple of days? So he got me a cheeseburger and Coke because I was underage at 17. And I spent a couple of days with them watching four shows and started a friendship now of 52 years. And true to his word, you know, a few weeks later when we got to L.A., I looked Neil up and took us under his wing, turned us on to David Briggs, his producer. And as we were making our rocky way looking for a record deal, that David produced four albums with Grin, and they were my biggest mentors, and I was living with David. And, you know, I was 18 years old a year later when Neil and David said they're doing an After the Gold Rush album and want me to play guitar, sing, and play piano. And when I told them I wasn't a professional piano player, they knew my history with the accordion and the contests and classical training, and they said, look, we need some simple parts, and we like your music, you know, your rhythm and melodic ideas, and we think you can handle it. And thank God at that point, instead of telling them I'm not a piano player, I just shut up and said, thank you, I'll do my best. And it led to an amazing record and experience for a young 18-year-old kid in his first year on the road.
When you
That is ridiculous. And if it wasn't obviously true, you would say that's a Hollywood story. You know, if they made the film of your life, you just wouldn't believe that. No, not only because Neil's reputation is so grumpy.
I didn't really believe it myself, and thankfully, because of Neil and David, I'd been living in Topanga Canyon. My band Grin was like the house band at the local corral. Neil would come down and jam with us. And because I was living with David Briggs, I would see Neil regularly. So it wasn't a case of, you meet this great player, and then, you know, a year later you get a call from a stranger. And it was very intimidating, but because of that, David and Neil and their friends in Topanga were kind of like, you know, I was the young kid. They were my older brothers and mentors, and I was around them all the time. So it gave me, as heady and intimidating as it was, there was a familiarity and a friendship, thanks to those two, that had been bred in for that year, that kind of had as much to do with making it work as my, you know, rookie piano abilities in the studio.
And I was going to say, Neil's reputation is that of being like a bit grumpy. So how the hell were you not just kicked in the backside and thrown out of that dressing room within 5 seconds? Or is that a complete misnomer? Is he actually a very friendly chap?
Well, yeah, I walked in on Neil, didn't know anything about him other than the Buffalo Springfield, and I spent 2 days getting to know him in Crazy Horse. I got out to L.A. and lived with David, saw Neil regularly. He's a great guy, very funny, brilliant, intelligent as hell, and, you know, a lot of common sense. I mean, David and Neil are very hard chargers in the sense that, you know, that this was serious business, but we all did it with a joy and a gratitude to have all these gifts. I mean, I still remember one night Neil came down and jammed with Grimm. We were a trio, and we had a ball. He just sat in and played along with our set, and it was really an honor. And it was just this funky little dive bar in Topanga. And then the next day, David and I are driving up to Neil's house. He said, "Hey, I got to go up and see Neil. Why don't you tag along?" So I'm on cloud nine because, you know, I've just jammed with Neil and my band Grin. And we get up to Neil's house, and of course, you know, as a young musician, very impressionable, you can imagine, I'm just really having a great day hanging out with Neil and David. And we get to Neil's house, and so all of a sudden they both get a little serious and say, "Hey, Nils, we got to talk to you about something." And I go, "Uh-oh, what's up?" Because the vibe got a little serious. And said, "Look, man, I enjoy playing with your band. I've been talking to David about it. You really got something solid going on there." We had two singers, Bob Berbrick, who's still alive and well, great singer and drummer. But they said, "You know what? I know you and David are looking for a record deal, and you've got songs to make a record, but you guys need a better bass player." Mm. And I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, man, I'm... And all of a sudden, there's Neil Young and David Briggs, who I love and admire, telling me, "You're going to have to break your band up and find a new bass player." Wow. So I went from cloud nine to feeling like, oh, my God. I was the one who wanted to be a professional musician, right? And this, it's not all fun and games. So long, long story short, because how can you argue with, you know, Neil Young and David Briggs? They were being sincere, and they had the experience and the know-how that I did not. And anyway, Bob Berbrick and I, long story short, we got Bob Gordon, fabulous bass player from D.C., who was a friend too in local bands and grown up with, to agree to quit his construction job and join Grin and play bass. And that was the change we made. We kept working hard. But, you know, it was another moment of like a very young, inexperienced teenager going, uh-oh, this is, you know, I'm the one who wanted to be in the big time and be a professional musician, and it's not all fun and games. And with people that, you know better, give you advice like that, you can't take it lightly or blow it off. You have to listen. And it was just another very, you know, powerful moment in my young musical life.
Absolutely. Talking about the actual recording of the album, I mean, did Neil demo the songs and kind of play you the songs beforehand, or was it much more relaxed than that?
Well, it was a bit of both. We got a remote truck set up outside of Neil's home in the Topanga Hills, way up on a bluff overlooking, you know, the beautiful canyons. And we had a little room that was set up with a, you know, an old board, Wally Hyder's board, this great analog board that David loved, we brought up there. So we would rehearse the songs a little bit and just kind of go over them. And then, you know, occasionally we'd brush, go over a few songs, and I'd take the ideas away and practice. John Locke, great friend of David's and the keyboard player for Spirit, who was a neighbor, he had a patio with an upright on it, and he literally said, look, I'll leave the door unlocked. You can come anytime. Don't worry about the noise. And, I mean, I literally would, like, sleep on the floor and just wake up and keep practicing because like a fish out of water on doing professional piano sessions. But it was easy and natural, you know. We'd learn a song. We'd try it a little bit, maybe tweak the arrangement. Neil would go up and have lunch on the patio above the studio. I would never leave the piano. I just never leave it. I would always just stay there and practice. And, you know, fortunately, they were right. They needed some simple parts. And looking back now, you know, you have Greg Reeves, who, brilliant bass player for Crosby, Stills and Nash and his own stuff and other sessions. But he had kind of a Jamie Jamerson style where he was fairly, you know, spoke a lot. It was not busy in a bad way, but very colorful. He would move around, keep the groove deep, but he had a lot of color. He added naturally and had a great style. And then you had Ralphie Molina on drums and me in the middle, very simple, a lot of space. And then Neil's above with his brilliant singing and playing. And it was just a great vibe and sound that, you know, if I had been some virtuoso just overplaying constantly, it would have had a different feel to it. And, it was just the four of us had a real good vibe and combination going, and it worked out beautifully. But, yeah, we rehearse a bit. Neil liked to get live vocals, so we wouldn't belabor it. But we touch on a few songs, and then we go to something else Neil wanted to sing. And, you know, there were breaks to rest, go up and enjoy a lunch or a canyon. And it gave me practice time to not only practice every moment I had that was downtime in the studio, but the second we left the studio, you know, I'd go to David's house, drop my bags, and go over to John Locke's porch and keep practicing.
I'm gonna give you till the morning comes. Till the morning comes. Till the morning comes. I'm only waiting till the morning comes. Till the morning comes. Till the morning comes.
Fantastic. That's amazing. There's also the great backstory of this, that Neil had a bit of a writer's block, and it was reading this script for a film that was never made, written by Dean Stockwell, who became like famous much later in life, and he was a child actor, wasn't he? And then over here, especially the show Quantum Leap, that was a massive success. But yeah, that Dean Stockwell had written this whole script, and that was what sort of really inspired Neil to write a lot of those songs. I mean, did you ever read that script, or were you aware of that whole backstory?
Not a lot. I was a little bit. You know, I kind of heard that backstory mentioned, but it wasn't belabored. When I was living with David, they would have card games every weekend, and Dean would be there, Russ Tamlin, West Side Story, Billy Gray, who is the son and Father Knows Best, an amazing, you know, sitcom, black and white sitcom in the 50s, 60s, and they'd all be part of David Briggs' card game. Danny Tucker, who was a dear friend, who was the road manager for Spirit and a neighbor of probably David's best friend outside of Neil, and they had these card games, and they were all friendly guys. I was like the young kid David took under his wing, and I heard that mentioned in the distance, but, you know, I was so kind of overwhelmed and grateful for the opportunity. It was tunnel vision on the songs, piano, which I wound up playing mostly piano on that record. Played a couple acoustic guitar parts on Tell Me Why and Till the Morning Comes. And I didn't have an acoustic guitar. And when Neil said, I'm going to put you on acoustic for a couple numbers, and I said, I don't have one. I said, well, borrow this one. And he gave me his old D18. I played on Tell Me Why and Till the Morning Comes. And at the end of the sessions, he said, hey, I want you to keep that Martin. You earned it. And I just was blown away. And, you know, I remember we had a long lunch break, so I ran off into the woods, just deep into the woods with this Martin guitar that, you know, Neil had been writing on through the 60s that he just gifted me, and just sat there in the trees and played and just marveled at my lucky life, you know, as a young musician while we're struggling to find a record deal with David and try to make some headway as a band. I get this opportunity at 18 to make that brilliant record.
Amazing. That is incredible. And looking back at the album now, which songs to you, I mean, it's a classic album now, and these songs have gone down in history. But which do you listen back to, and do you listen out for your parts and think, oh, I particularly like my part on such and such a song?
Not really. I listen to it as a whole, and of course I'm happy to hear myself be a part of it successfully. But one song in particular that always tickles me is it's a great story too, in Southern Man. It's a piano song, and it's a halftime groove, and we started learning the song. Neil took a lunch break. Everyone went up to have lunch, and I stayed behind, of course, practicing piano, getting used to the changes. And this particular day, Ralphie Molina, the great drummer, didn't go have lunch. He stayed behind with me, and we were just jamming on Southern Man as a halftime thing, you know, bum, bum, whack, ba bum, bum, whack, that kind of halftime beat. Ralphie completely changed the beat in double time, to, you know, went back, back, back into a double time feel, and we came up with this roaring jam that is the solo in Southern Man. And when David and Neil came back from lunch, we were just going to town on that groove, which was completely different vibe than the halftime feel. Mm-hmm. And they were both like, what the hell is that? And I said, well, that's Southern Man with a polka beat. We laughed. And they said, well, look, let's try that in the solo. When we hit the solo, let's go to that groove and then break back down to halftime for the last verse. And when Neil's ready, he'll kick off a solo out at the end and go back to that groove. So you'll hear the track Southern Man drastically change time in the middle. Yeah. Out of the blue. We just kick into double time, and then we just drop right back in for the singing to the halftime feel. And once again at the end, after a few rounds, all of a sudden Ralphie picks it up, and we just go roaring out on the double time feel with Neil playing that great lead on Old Black. Mm-hmm. And it was really neat that my square accordion days led to a cool arrangement change on such a great album. But, you know, so that track means a lot to me. Why, singing live with Neil, sitting across from him with this Martin, he gifted me in doing Tell Me Why, and also Only Love Can Break Your Heart is another favorite.
Yeah.
Of course, in Tell Me Why and Only Love Can Break Your Heart, we got our dear friend Danny Whitten comes down, sings harmony with Ralphie, just adds some great vocals to it. So it's all, you know, beautiful stuff, but those are some of my favorites.
Tell me why. Tell me why. Is it hard to make arrangements with yourself when you're old enough to repay but young enough to sell?
Absolutely. I mean, that's interesting you mentioned Danny Whitten there, because, you know, that's kind of a nice transition to the next album that you did with Neil, that as I say, has made this 1001 Greatest Albums list, which is Tonight's the Night. And we are going to put a pen in it there to come back and hear the rest of the discussion. We've got part two covering Neil Young's Tonight's the Night, which will be with you very shortly, or if you listen to this in the future, it's already up as the next episode. And then after that, we will also be discussing Bruce Springsteen's The Rising. So three for the price of one. Absolutely fantastic. Make sure you're checking out Nils's fantastic live album, Weathered. The links of how you can get hold of that are in the description below. And we will be back next time for another fascinating discussion with Nils, covering Neil Young's Tonight's the Night.
Hey, hey, Cripple Creek Ferry, butting through the overhanging trees. Make way for the Cripple Creek Ferry, the water.